Hello and welcome to another episode of South Asia Chat, the podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. My name is Karthik Nachipan. I'm a research fellow here at the Institute working on issues related to technology and global governance. And today we have the great pleasure of speaking to Urvashi Aneja, the founding director of Tandem Research, on their organization's recent report on big tech in India. Urvashi, welcome.
Thank you, Karthik. Pleasure to join you.
Before I talk about the report, can you briefly tell us about your organization, Tandem Research?
Yeah, sure. So we set up Tandem Research about 3.5 years ago. At that point, conversations around the digital economy in India were becoming more and more mainstream, and there was a strong kind of narrative around the innovation and productivity gains that would accrue to India as a result of new emerging tech. And we felt that there was a gap in the kind of mainstream policy conversations in terms of thinking about both the societal impacts of digital transformations as well as the environmental impact. And we also felt that there was a gap between kind of academic research on any of these issues and how that academic research was informing policy conversations. So those two kind of motivations led us to set up Tandem. And now we describe ourselves as a research collective that works at the interface of technology, society, and sustainability. And we have kind of four broad areas of work. One is our AI and society program. The other is our Future of Work and Learning program. And then we have two other research streams around climate and sustainability, one other research stream on climate and sustainability, and a fourth on future cities. So our work kind of cuts across the technology, rights, and sustainability space. And we feel very privileged to be based out of Goa in India. Yeah, so that's Tandem.
Right. I'm just curious, how does it help being based in Goa than, say, Bangalore or Mumbai or New Delhi? Does that help in any way that you have some distance from these dialogues that are taking place in other parts of the country?
That was certainly the intention. I'm from Delhi and I have spent most of my professional life in Delhi. I used to teach there and also work for a think tank in Delhi. And it really felt that the think tank space was very, very crowded. And in some sense, everyone was jostling for the ear of the government and jostling for that kind of space. And there needed to be a certain distance from power to be able to provide a kind of informed critique, an informed kind of response that was not reactionary, right? That you had that time to kind of sit back and think of some of these things more analytically, think of them on a longer kind of time frame. So I think it certainly helps to have that distance. It was a big gamble. I think there were certainly many moments, and I'm sure there will continue to be many moments where we wondered we were totally crazy, like who goes to Goa and sets up a policy shop in Goa. But I think one of the things that it really helped us do was, aside from have that space from policy, it also from power, it also allowed us to get people in, right, and not speak on behalf of their organizations, to leave that organizational baggage behind or that organizational voice behind, because you were an open space and you weren't bumping into the same crowd of people, or you weren't worried how that was going to be perceived by the press or how it was going to be perceived by others in the think tank community. So I think what we managed to do being in Goa is create a much more open space for having some of these conversations. And we do manage to get people from really opposite ends of the spectrum in thinking about tech policy into a same room together for 2 days and to be able to have that chat. So I think that's really worked to our advantage as well. And that's helped us kind of enter the policy space in a different way and establish some kind of niche for ourselves.
Great. So let's talk about the big tech report. I'm interested to know about the genesis of this research on big tech in India. What prompted you to investigate this issue?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a lot of chatter around big tech, right? And I think the antitrust conversations have been becoming louder in the US and Europe. In India as well, there's been a lot of concern around Facebook and misinformation, for an example, and hate speech. But a lot of it, and I think two things were happening. One is a lot of these conversations were blurring, right? There was a lot of rhetoric. There was a lot of kind of posturing. And I think people's positions were often shaped by quite ideological kind of commitments to how one sees the role of the state or sees the role of private corporations, etc. So we felt a need to kind of create a structure or a framework to be able to have these conversations rather than all kind of being, you know, collapsing on each other and everyone putting out one op-ed after the other. So we wanted to bring some structure to it. But the other thing that we felt was that a lot of the conversations, or that we needed to have a conversation situated in the Indian context, that the benefits, the harms, the trade-offs, the challenges in the Indian context are not the same as they would be in industrialized economies, whether it's in terms of regulatory capacity and state capacity, or whether it's even in terms of the ability of the state to be hold these big tech companies responsible, right? Like, I can't imagine, I mean, you know, the Indian parliament has tried to get Zuckerberg to testify, but that's not going to happen, right? So there needed to be a different set of conversations for India. There needed to be a more structured way of thinking about this that was able to, or let me rephrase it, that didn't kind of throw out the baby with the bathwater, mm-hmm. right? That there is some benefit we felt that big tech companies do bring to the Indian context, particularly in context of where India is in its development story right now. And some of the very strong kind of critique of big tech was not able to disaggregate those benefits and harms.
Right.
Yeah.
So big tech, you know, is generally used to identify, you know, as you mentioned, these large global tech companies, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Apple, who have amassed tremendous market power and clout, not just in the United States, but now seemingly everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. Even in India, this is becoming quite an important issue. Just last week, there was a Wall Street Journal article which talked about Facebook's operations in India and how cozy its ties have gotten with the BJP government and the implications of not policing the actions of certain BJP ministers on their platform. But you know, in your report, you characterize big tech as a concept and not as a set of companies as it's conventionally understood. What do you mean by that?
I think the idea with saying that big tech is a concept was to say that there's certain kind of characteristics that are common to these companies. Can we distill those out, right? And I think that other companies can enter that big tech category. Certain companies may leave that big tech category, but there's a certain kind of trajectory we see around how some of these large technology giants are operating that goes beyond their specific company, right? So there's certain kind of models, there's certain kind of strategies, there's certain kind of marketplace that are not only specific to that company. And we already see in the Indian context, right? I mean, Reliance Jio is a good example, I think, of a company that is certainly resembling many of the characteristics of big tech. I think we also wanted to find a way, to be able to talk about certain characteristics rather than talk about certain companies, right? And does thinking about those characteristics help you think more clearly about the policy levers that one needs or the policy implications that it might have? Right. So one of the arguments we make in our report, for an example, is that we don't consider Microsoft to be big tech. Mm. Right. And the reason we say that Microsoft is not big tech is because its business does not rely on a consumer facing model. And what we see is it doesn't have the same kind of civic power as a Google does. Right. But now with Microsoft looking into buying TikTok in the US, a number of those issues that confront other big tech companies, whether it's around content moderation, around privacy, or just having that direct consumer relationship, are likely to prop up. Right. So I think that was the idea, to think of it in terms of characteristics and what that means for policy, and then to think of, and to allow that framework then to have new entrants join or certain companies leave that club.
Right. You know, it's ironic you bring up Microsoft, because in the late 90s, when Microsoft was facing a lot of regulatory issues in the United States and was forced to divide some of its own operations, and that disaggregation arguably led to the rise of some of these new companies that we're talking about, who have become very huge players in their own right. So Microsoft, you know, in many ways could be the source of the problems that we're talking about now. And they're coming back to join the clubs in one way. So the four conceptual features that your report states in characterizing big tech is that, number one, they're data driven. Second, they have network effects given their size. Third, the size allows them to play or have an infrastructural role and capacity over other firms and actors, largely through their digital services. And fourth, they perform certain civic functions, particularly when it comes to media, news, and regulating social and societal interactions. But it appears to me as though, you know, these core aspects come down to data or the information that they collect, which allows them to grow, expand, diversify, build better services and applications, and become more functional. Would that be an accurate description? Does it all come down to data?
I think it's a big part of it comes down to data, certainly, right? But I think that there are other things that are also relevant. Some of those other points are offshoots of data. So for an example, I do think it is relevant that these companies are able to vertically integrate within a certain platform, right? Part of that vertical integration is enabled by the data intelligence they're able to gather as that platform. And that is what enables a more successful vertical integration. So that's an offshoot of it, right? But I do think that there's other things that are relevant here, which are in some sense not necessarily unique or directly unique to the digital economy. And if you look at how a number of these big tech firms have grown, a lot of it has also been through acquisitions. A lot of it has also been through their lobbying power, right? In the United States, even kind of rules around intermediary liability or them having the safe harbor provision is not solely a function of data, right? But it is a function of kind of lobbying power. If you look at the number of companies that Google has purchased over the past decade, or if you look at what Reliance is doing right now, I mean, sure, that the choice of companies and the choice of strategies is certainly shaped by their data intelligence, but it's also more old school kind of market dynamics at play. Right. So it does come back to data, but I don't think if we look just at data, we'd be able to fully understand how these firms have risen to prominence. And I think if we look just at data, there is a risk that we might only try to govern the data end of it. Right. But I think there is a broader set of issues that also need governance. And so it's helpful to at least think about the implications of that data across other issues, like, for an example, acquisitions or mergers or thinking about vertical integration.
Right. So let's just talk a little bit about how big tech manifests in India. How prevalent and dominant is big tech in India today? And I'm not just talking about the American big tech companies. Is there an Indian big tech emerging?
Yes. The two-word answer is yes, Reliance. Right. I think there's two parts to your question. One is on the big tech presence in India. I mean, I think the big tech presence in India is huge, right? And I think one of the things that is unique about the big tech presence in India compared to other geographies is that it's actually filling gaps in state capacity, right? So whether it's in terms of enabling digitalization through Wi-Fi or providing, creating market infrastructure or even providing the cloud space for governments through AWS, right? So I think in many ways, actually filling gaps in state capacity and are a huge part of India's development story. In terms of the American big tech, I think there is a strong kind of sense that there needs to be an Indian big tech, right? And that's the kind of sense that you get from government. They may not say it in those terms, but there's maybe the better way is to phrase it. There needs to be a counterpoint to the presence of the American big tech companies in India. And I think that one of the reasons for that, or one of the concerns, is that the distribution of kind of technology gains is not being equitably spread. So India is a huge market for Facebook, but Facebook doesn't have a single data center in India, for an example, right? So that we need, or that Google, that India is a huge market for Google and Facebook, but the actual employment numbers on the ground are very, very low, right? And you don't have very senior people from your product management teams actually sitting here. I think that is the kind of policy push that there needs to be a stronger counterpart to the global big tech. And I think that counterpart is emerging in the form of Reliance. What is very different about Reliance is that it started as a telecom company, right? That gives it a slightly different trajectory than what we see with the other big tech companies. And if you look at the new investments that have come into Reliance, if you think of it as some kind of like consumer stack, right? Like you have your hardware, you have your software, you have your telecom. I mean, they now have investments across the whole consumer stack, right? More than even what a Google would have in terms of spread of investments or what a Facebook would have in India. So I think Reliance is certainly emerging as a strong contender for an Indian big tech. And I think other companies are going to start looking at it too, right? I think just yesterday, the Tata Group announced that they want to launch their own new super app, similar to a WeChat kind of model. Again, they have previously been in the telecom space. They have numerous other business verticals. And I guess the idea is to try and see how you can, combine the data intelligence across all these verticals to create a super app, right, for consumers. So I think there will be more also. But I think the problem is that it's also not so easy to talk about global or Indian big tech, right? Because if you look at how the funding works, it's not like the funding for some of these emerging unicorns in India is coming from India alone. Like a lot of it might be coming from China or from Singapore, as you'd mentioned. So that kind of distinction on what is Indian and global was already blurry, and I think it's going to continue to be blurry or get blurrier.
Reliance and Reliance Jio has been quite prolific in tapping investments in the last few months from global tech players like Facebook and a few others. So my guess is that this is partly geopolitically driven, that India and the United States are looking to form a closer partnership on the technology front. But when you look at it from a commercial economic sort of point of view, does it make sense for Reliance to tie up with a competitor like Facebook in India when just a few years ago it was trying to edge them out of the country?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's too early to tell on one hand on whether it makes commercial sense or not. But I mean, I think for Reliance, if you look at the Facebook deal, Reliance had really struggled to get Jio money off the ground. Right. And with the partnership with WhatsApp and the lack of the difficulty in getting Jio money off the ground also meant it was going to be harder to get Jio platforms off the ground, right? And to get that kind of consumer buy-in into Jio platforms. But with the partnership with Facebook, you now have that whole audience that is already using WhatsApp, right? And you can, and you know, WhatsApp is waiting to get kind of clearance from the RBI on payments, and now we have that as well. So I think in terms of expanding its market presence, right, the Reliance Facebook deal is possibly good for Reliance, right? I mean, I don't know what the kind of data sharing agreements are between Reliance and Facebook, but if they are fairly permissive data sharing agreements, and that would also potentially be beneficial for Reliance, at least in terms of being able to expand its customer base, right, and to expand its market presence. Whether that market presence then means profitability, I think, is a whole other question.
Right. It does get to the question of the Indian state, and you just briefly talked about it in your earlier response. The Indian state has a lot of technology infrastructures that they have invested in the last 10, 15 years, and which they are hoping would serve as an example, not just for software developers to use and deploy, but also software developers and hardware developers in other countries that they can serve as a model. It looks like big tech is increasingly working with the state in India by allowing its digital tools and infrastructures to enable the state discharge certain functions better, especially when it comes to welfare and subsidies and other development tasks. But this nexus does raise concerns, you know, with respect to privacy, democratic accountability, and the efficient functioning of markets, including antitrust measures. Is big tech colluding with the state in India? Or is the state...
colluding with big tech in India.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the word colluding, right? I mean, I think the big tech realizes that big tech companies feel a need to have a positive and healthy relationship with the state in order to expand its own market and to have a favorable policy environment for their own products and services and for their own growth, right? The state certainly relies on big tech for a lot of the infrastructure that they provide, right? So the Indian state, for an example, uses AWS, right? And AWS, I think, is, well, yeah, so the Indian state uses AWS, and even some of the, like Google has put up these Wi-Fi hotspots, and a lot of the national, a lot of Facebook has been very involved in some of the national disaster management efforts by triangulating Facebook's WhatsApp data, et cetera, to help provide insights to the Indian state, right? So there are many points of collaboration, and there's many mutual dependencies, right? Would either of them like to have those mutual dependencies? Maybe not, right? So those dependencies might be circumstantially driven rather than the ideal state of affairs, right? And I think, so you do see a lot of pushback also by the state on big tech, right? Whether it's in terms of competition recently around misinformation and the Facebook story that that you mentioned in the beginning of our chat. Most recently around non-personal data, I think that's the best example of the state trying to rein in some of the power of big tech, or at least trying to assert itself over big tech, right? Because essentially what the non-personal data consultation document says is that that data belongs to the state, right? And companies have to give that data over to the state so that the state can use it for the purposes of development and economic growth and help distribute those benefits more equitably within the Indian ecosystem. So that's, I think, a really good recent example of the state trying to assert itself, right, vis-a-vis big tech. So I'm not sure if it's a collusion, right? I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. And neither are exactly where they would like it to be, but are uncomfortable bedfellows.
Right. It's a marriage of convenience.
Yeah. So yeah.
Sort of. Yeah, exactly.
So,
you know, as you mentioned, there appears to be a backlash against these tech companies worldwide. Now it's called a techlash. States all over the world are looking to claw these big, powerful companies back through different kinds of rules and regulations. Which conceptual marker, drawing from your report, most threatens governments worldwide?
I mean, I think it's a combination of their infrastructure and their civic power. Right. I think when you start having a very few handful of companies providing your basic digital infrastructure, certainly that raises governance challenges. And then that has implications for them having civic power, right, or enables the civic power or augments the civic power of these companies. And that certainly creates questions around democratic accountability, right, and questions about what is the role of the state? How should the state be reining in these companies, or what should they be doing when there's also a kind of dependence on them? And I think we've seen it over and over again, right? I mean, and it's not just specific to India. I mean, worldwide, the role of Facebook around elections, equally, you know, the role that Google has played, or inadvertently or intentionally. So I think to me, it's those two, right? Because essentially you're providing public infrastructure, right? But you're not publicly accountable. So how do you build that public accountability if you're providing that basic infrastructure?
Right. And I guess that comes down to states themselves to govern these different tech companies and these different technologies better, and having effective laws and rules that forces them to behave a certain way, and not have them in a way, you know, go back to what American laws are, and I guess abide by those when they're operating worldwide, right? That sort of regulatory vacuum, in some sense, creates a gap that all these different states across Asia and other parts of the world have to somehow fail, right? And when the vacuum exists, it just gives more power to these companies who can then lobby for certain rules in their favor.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that's exactly it, right? And that's one of the points we make in our report also, that we have to take this question of state capacity very seriously. If you want to regulate these companies and you want to rein them in, so on, like, well, you have to build that state capacity. You have to build that regulatory capacity. And in India, it's fairly weak right now. So unless you have that in place, I mean, you can pass the buck, or you can blame big tech all you want, right? But if you don't have the capacity to regulate them, then there's a problem there. I mean, and just to take the recent example around the Facebook, the Wall Street Journal article where they called out the senior public policy manager of Facebook in India. Yes, there was a problem with Facebook, but an incitement to violence is illegal regardless of what Facebook does. So the regulator did not step in. So it's not just the fault of Facebook here. I mean, yeah. You know, that's another conversation. But Facebook is not democratically accountable to the Indian citizen the same way the regulator is. And the regulator should have stepped in to what was a blatant incitement of violence, and that had been brought to the attention of the regulator by numerous society organizations and in the media. It was right there, staring at everyone in the face, right? But the regulator didn't step in. So now it's very easy to call up Facebook and say that, why didn't you do this? And why your company policy is not like this? And why is it that the same person is managing government liaison and policy and content related decisions, right? So sure, there is an argument that Facebook should split up those roles, but there is still huge responsibility that has to be borne by the regulator in this context. And they did not fulfill that responsibility. So it's a good example that you can change Facebook's business model, and there's fundamental issues with it. But unless you have that regulatory capacity in place, it'll be very hard to move the conversation forward.
Right. So if India has that regulatory capacity, if there's sufficient knowledge within bureaucracy to deal with these problems, what should the Indian state do to ward off a digital future that is controlled by these big tech firms?
Identify four buckets of policy pathways that we feel the state needs to pursue. One of them is around competition policy, and we argue that competition policy needs to be updated to include control over data, to include network effects, and to include the impact of new mergers and acquisitions on the prospects of healthy competition in the market. I think for very long, and this is a conversation that's obviously happening in the US already, for very long, competition policy has been judging the action of corporations depending in terms of the price available to customers and what that meant. But obviously in the case of these zero price platforms, that price, the cost to customer, has to be reevaluated. And I also think that we need a longer view on thinking about harm to customers. And that harm to customer is not only about price, but it's also about that loss of control over data and what that could mean both for individuals and what that could mean also for markets. So I do think there is a strong role for competition policy. I do think that if we start thinking about these platforms as infrastructures, then there is something to be taken from how we regulate other public utilities. So you can't, for an example, own both the railroads and the companies that are running trains on it, right? So similarly, for these platforms, they should not be allowed to discriminate against other players on their platforms. And I think we see evidence of this happening across a number of platforms, whether it's Amazon or Google. So I think thinking about platform neutrality is really important. I also think about platform interoperability is also very important as a way to address the network effects that these companies have. So those kind of, one bucket is around kind of market policies. The other kind of set of policies that we recommend is around trying to improve the transparency and accountability of social media and news platforms. And that I think requires a couple of things. I think for a long time we have thought of platforms or as kind of neutral spaces, right? But if you begin to think of them as curators and editors of information, then they have certain responsibilities as curators and editors of that information. So to me, for an example, one of the concerns on these platforms is not that there's hate speech, right? But that there's algorithmic amplification of that hate speech, right? Mm-hmm. So the concern again is not misinformation, but the amplification of that misinformation, because that is what your algorithms are optimized to do, right? Because you're trying to hit that virality. So I think we need a kind of set of publisher ethics to come into this space. And we also need greater transparency and accountability around how how algorithmic amplification works and what these algorithms are optimizing for. We do need to have that. I also think we do need to have greater... we don't talk about it much in the report, but I think having a stronger employee base in the country in which you have a huge market presence and in which you run a lot of the basic digital and civic infrastructure is actually really important, because it creates another level of accountability. Otherwise, it's really not clear what that accountability is to. Right. So, for an example, when we saw employees of Google or employees of Facebook protest against certain content takedowns or lack of content takedowns or certain partnerships with the military, you could vote with your feet. Right. The employees were voting with their feet and saying, hey, this is not on. This is not the kind of company I want to work for. Right. This is not my aspiration. I think we don't have that here. Right. And we don't have that in many parts of the global south. So you don't have enough feet on the ground to make you domestically accountable. I think the third kind of set of issues that we talk about is privacy. Again, this is obviously not a big tech issue alone, but big tech, we do argue that a lot of the standard setting is around big tech, is done by big tech, and big tech platforms also become a kind of honeypot for other bad actors. And so you need different kinds of privacy policies, which are about individual rights and consent, but also don't stop there, right? We need much, much stronger accountability frameworks that hold big tech companies accountable for misuse and don't just put all the onus on individual users to be able to guarantee their rights, right? But I think most fundamentally need different business models. Right, we need to have privacy respecting business models, and we need better research around those. We need better empirical evidence around those, and there are examples of those succeeding. Right, they may not be at the same kind of profit margins as big tech companies, but they're not failing companies either. Right, so I think aside from that bucket on state and market capacity and regulatory capacity, these are the three other buckets that the Indian state would need to focus on in order to rein in the power of some of these big tech companies.
Right. I want to end by asking you, what worries you the most about big tech in India?
I think there's maybe... I mean, there's many, so I'm just trying to identify what is the one that worries me the most. I think there's a great amount of dependency on big tech, which makes it harder to regulate big tech. I think with Reliance Jio emerging as a new big tech actor, there is a fairly close relationship between an emerging big tech actor and the Indian state, and that could prevent the kind of oversight that is needed, from the kind of independent, transparent oversight that is needed. And I think the third worry for me is what I've mentioned earlier about just feet on the ground. That if these are your biggest markets and you don't have enough feet on the ground, and a lot of the regulatory issues are beyond the jurisdictional ambit of the Indian state, then where does that accountability come from, right? So how do you hold a boardroom accountable? How do you hold a big tech company accountable in India so that you don't you don't have to just chuck them out or ban them, right? Which is often the response, or you don't have to do extreme measures like data localization, right? So what are the other ways to actually hold these companies accountable when they have such a huge presence in India, they have a huge amount of civic power, but very little civic responsibility?
Great. Urvashi, thank you so much for joining us and sharing more about the report on big tech in India. We've been speaking with Urvashi Aneja, the founding director of Tandem Research, and one of the authors of a very interesting report on big tech in India.
Thank you, Karthik. It was a pleasure.